Hello, and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan U.S. Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, managing editor of the Phelan U.S. Center's blog on U.S. politics and policy, USAP. In September 2024, I spoke to Nick Lewis, a PhD student in LSE's Department of Government. Nick's research looks at how social media creates bias in democratic deliberation. He also focuses on political behavior and its interaction with communication, psychology, polarization, and nationalism. Nick was a recipient of a Phelan U.S. Center PhD summer research grant in 2022. We spoke about how Facebook discourages people from taking part in discussions via what's called the spiral of silence. We also talked about the importance of social media in the 2024 presidential election. Thank you so much for joining us in the ballpark today. It's wonderful to be able to speak to you. So you're a PhD candidate in the LSE Department of Government. Can you give our audience a quick overview of what your PhD research covers? Thank you.
Oh, first of all, thanks so much for having me. It's really nice to be here. So broadly, I am researching the effect of social media on political discussion. And I'm doing a paper-based thesis on that. So basically, that means that I can look at different aspects of that in detail. So for example, I started by looking at how MPs became more emotional in their tweets over time and exploring potential reasons for that shift. I was also curious about whether we're more likely to hear more extreme voices online, whether we're more likely to hear more ideologically or effectively extreme voices when we go online. And then finally, from a final paper, I did a field experiment which tried to unpick what causes people to hold back from expressing their opinions. And that was really based on conversations I'd had with friends who said, I'm into politics, but I don't talk about it online. And I was really, really interested in why that is.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to delve a bit into some more aspects of your research. And one of them is what's called the spiral of silence. So your research looks at something called the spiral of silence theory and how that relates to social media, specifically Facebook. Can you talk a bit about what the spiral of silence is and how you've looked at it?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a theory which was conceived in the 70s, actually. And it was conceived by a political scientist, really well-known political scientist called Elizabeth Noel Neumann. And she argued that individuals are hesitant to express an opinion, which they believe to be in the minority, due to a fear of social isolation. And that leads to a sort of self-reinforcing cycle where dominant opinions become more prominent and consequently perceived as the majority, while dissenting or minority views are suppressed effectively. Now, I've actually taken the spiral of silence theory and adapted a little bit in light of how I think social media are changing the way that we talk about politics, which I can come on and talk about a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, could you maybe give our listeners a bit of an example about how, what would the spiral of silence look like in a political discussion or maybe a discussion that strays into politics on Facebook?
So for example, if you log onto Facebook and you see a conversation happening, what Noel Neumann suggested happens is that you basically try to obtain some kind of quasi-statistical sense of what the dominant opinion is. And then depending on whether you perceive your opinion to be in accordance with that dominant opinion, you choose whether to express that opinion effectively. So if you think about it in a face-to-face sense, I was in Wisconsin recently, for example, and it's obviously a bit of a marginal state in the presidential elections coming up. And I was in a bar and I thought, God, I love to talk about politics, but I'm not really sure who I can talk to about politics here. I'm not really sure who's got what opinions and whether or not they'll be well received. Now, I think the spiral of silence is actually expedited by Facebook a little bit. And that's for a number of different reasons. I think that on Facebook, for example, compared to other social media sites, you're unable to be anonymous. It's really difficult to be anonymous on Facebook. Anonymity actually reduces the sort of social cost, the cost of potential social isolation that people might fear when they're choosing whether or not to share their opinion. Linked to that, I think Facebook networks are more likely to be comprised of real-world connections. So friends and family, co-workers, etc. So that raises the likelihood of real-world social consequences, things that could happen if you express a dissenting opinion. So losing your job, being unfriended, you know, not being talked to by your mad uncle, for example. And I think as well on social media, Facebook in particular, there are many more ways to actually evaluate the opinion environment. You know, thinking about that bar, it's quite difficult to evaluate who's going to have what opinion. But if you log into Facebook, you can see things that people have said, you can see reactions to other people's comments, and you can quite quickly get an idea of the balance of opinion. And I think that helps expedite this idea that people are less willing to express their opinion when it comes to contentious political issues.
And just to say, depending on the age of who is listening, I know we talk a lot about the TikTok and Twitter, now X. Facebook is still a very important force in politics, isn't it? Despite the fact that for a lot of people, it's gone away.
Yeah, I think so. When I told my nephews that I was doing this research, they were like, oh, why are you looking at Facebook? It's populated by boomers and we're not on it, for example. And I said, okay, that is important, but ultimately these are the people that still vote in elections. And people are still on there. It might not be relevant for the younger generations. We'll probably come on to talk a little bit about TikTok and the presidential campaign and stuff, but Facebook is still important and people do still discuss political issues on Facebook. There's still a huge amount of misinformation on Facebook as well. So figuring out how people talk about politics on platforms like that, I think it's hugely important.
And do you think there might be, you know, what happens on Facebook can happen in other social media networks as well, potentially?
Well, I think there are some important differences. I think that, you know, having a sort of public, at least private or semi-public network like Facebook makes it fairly unique. And in that, I think when, like I was saying, when you're surrounded by friends and family, I think potentially the social consequences are quite real. If you think about a network like Twitter, which has sort of become the Wild West since Elon Musk took over, you can be anonymous. So the cost of social isolation is maybe much lower. You can say what you want effectively. And I think that has real implications for how people talk about politics.
When we think about social media, often the focus is on who's doing the talking and the things that they are saying. Your work looks at people who choose not to take part in these discussions. So why do people choose not to take part and why is that really important?
That's a really good question. And I was really conscious in the first two papers that I did as part of my thesis that a lot of research focuses on those that we're most likely to hear. And what we don't talk about so much is the reasons why people choose to disengage from politics. And what I argue in the paper where I look at self-censorship is that two key things matter. I think the first thing is issue type. And this is where I've adapted some of the spiral of silence theory. Now, Elizabeth Noel Neumann argued that a spiral of silence could only happen when the issue being discussed was controversial or had a moral component. And I think this makes sense because controversial issues tend to evoke quite strong emotional responses. But they also come with strong societal norms about what we consider acceptable or unacceptable. So what that means is when it comes to discussing issues like that, controversial issues, we face quite strong societal pressures to conform to these societal norms. And added to that, in the research, we still don't know a huge amount about whether contentious issues are all that different to non-contentious or consensus issues. So that's the first thing I argue. I think that that the issue being discussed is of paramount importance when it comes to people choosing whether to engage or disengage. The second thing I argue that's important is group identity. Now, there's a huge body of work out there on social conformity, which really finds that people either share or censor their opinions to fit in with a group norm. And a big caveat to my study here, I did study the US, which of course is particularly polarized and polarized between Republicans and Democrats. That polarization is ideological as well, which was useful for my study because it means that one side thinks their opinion on a range of issues is completely different to the opinions of someone from the other group. So taking all of this together, I think this leads to a situation where you might disengage from discussing controversial topics in environments where you're uncertain that your opinion is in the majority or the minority. And you do that to avoid these social consequences, whether that's being ostracized from a group, or if you think about it in an online context, being unfriended or being blocked from someone, or even things that could have real world social consequences, like being doxxed, you know, having your information put online, or even losing your job, for example.
So thinking about how this might shape what online discussions on Facebook look like, if members of the public or journalists or people interested in politics are seeing these discussions and they tend to have one particular view, because from what you're saying, the views that counter that might not feel like they can speak. Does that then mean that from the outside, it looks like opinion about a certain issue in politics is mostly one way when in actual fact, there's a lot more viewpoint diversity that we're just not seeing?
I think that's true. And another thing that plays into this, and it sort of relates back to your question about how different social media networks can look when it comes to political discussion, is that, again, it's different across different networks, because on Facebook, for example, you cannot curate your own network, or it's difficult to curate your own network based on your ideology. Whereas you can do that on Twitter. You can think, I only want to see content from people who think like me. So that leads to echo chambers. I think on a private or semi-public network like Facebook, you are a little bit more likely to see opinions from the other side. You can curate your own network to a certain extent. So that leads to that situation where you think, well, everybody thinks like me, so actually I'm going to put forward my opinion.
So as part of your research, you've done a pilot study. Can you talk about your pilot study, how you ran it, and what your sort of early findings were?
Absolutely, yeah. So when I was thinking about self-censorship on social media, I realized that most of the research that's been done was conducted exclusively through either surveys or lab experiments, on platforms which tried to replicate social media. And there's lots of really, really great research out there, which has looked at various different aspects of it. But I think to get closer to generalizable results, I've been really keen to see how people behave actually on the platforms themselves and in situations which quite closely resemble an everyday experience on social media. So what happens when you open Facebook on your phone or you open Twitter on your phone, for example? So what I did was I used Facebook targeted ads to recruit supporters of either the Republican or the Democratic parties. They clicked on that ad, they were taken to a short survey, they were asked a few questions, including demographic details, ideology, etc., etc. And then at the end of the survey, I invited them to share their Facebook profile. And the nice thing about Facebook is that I can actually use Facebook groups to assign participants to different treatment conditions. The treatments in this case, I used news articles, and they were discussing either two contentious issues, which for this experiment were immigration and abortion, or they were discussing two consensus issues or non-contentious issues. So in this case, it was strong economy and better education, which people generally agreed on. It's actually quite difficult to find non-contentious issues in the US at the moment, sadly. So ultimately, this meant that I could vary two things. I could vary the type of issue being discussed, what people were exposed to, but I could also vary the partisan composition of the group to see how people reacted when they were in groups with all like-minded people, or how they reacted when they were in a mixed group. So when I'd assigned people to these groups, each study period took place over 5 days from Monday to Friday. To qualify for their gift card, participants were required to visit their group on each of those 5 days and vote in a poll. Now, immediately after that poll, I posted one of these articles, which meant that every day when they were visiting the group to vote in their poll, they were exposed to a particular piece of content, piece of news content, which discussed one of these issues. Now, the other nice thing about Facebook is you can pretty much infinitely adjustable. So I could adjust all the group settings so that people had to scroll past these news articles. They had to be treated. And I could check this using what's known as the seen by metric. And I measured basically how much they engaged with each other in those groups. So whether that was commenting on other people's posts, whether that was clicking like or laugh or sad or whatever it was. And I really focused on comments as that kind of key outcome variable, because I think it takes much more time to actually sit and think about what you're going to say in a Facebook comment. And it takes much greater cognitive effort. And there's a much greater risk of that social isolation as well. So that's how I constructed the study. It was a lot of admin for one person to run. but I think my main fears weren't realized, and that I was concerned that people were going to just basically take their incentive, turn up, do the tasks, and not engage. But actually, people talked quite a bit in the groups. It turns out that some of these things really make people want to talk about politics. I saw some evidence when taken alone that actually being exposed to a contentious issue or being in a mixed group in isolation actually led people to engage more, comment more, like more, for example, which I didn't expect, I have to be honest. In my pre-registration, I didn't expect that to happen. But in retrospect, I think that makes perfect sense, because if you care about an issue or you see it as being high consequence, something like abortion, something like immigration, you're going to be more motivated to comment on it. And I think it makes intuitive sense, and I can't believe I didn't realize this at the time. However, the most interesting thing for me actually was the interaction between contentious issues and mixed groups. When people were exposed to contentious issues, where there was high likelihood of disagreement, and when they were mixed in with people from the other side, that's really where I saw a chilling effect on the likelihood of people engaging. And that's really where you might say that some form of this spiral of silence exists online.
Social media is obviously of huge importance in this year's presidential election, and in quite a few of the most recent presidential elections as well. What can your research tell us about what we should be paying attention to in this area?
Yeah, well, that's a really great question. And it has been fashionable over the last few presidential elections, probably going back 10, 15 years now, to brand them as either the Facebook election or the Twitter election. And this time, people seem really keen to brand it as the TikTok election, which is probably closer to the truth now that Kamala Harris is running instead of Biden, because of the nimble way her campaign have used TikTok and the success they've had on it over the last, 6-8 weeks. But I still don't think we can yet call it the TikTok election. I mean, campaigns are still projected to spend something like $1 billion on paid digital ads on the big platforms like Facebook and Google, for example. But I do think, even though we can't yet call it the pivotal TikTok election, I think its influence has spread to some of the other platforms. And I think it's sparked a slight shift in the campaign tactics of politicians as well. One notable change, I think, is a shift from some of these glossy, big budget, paid, targeted ad campaigns that you see towards more grassroots or low or no cost organic content. So for example, when we when Biden was still running, we saw his campaign doing more of those mini events that they think might go viral on social media. So for example, the president comes for dinner with your family. It's filmed by one of the kids and goes semi-viral on TikTok or YouTube, for example. And Joe Biden's sort of folksy charm is quite good for that. And it's a trend that we're seeing across the board in that campaigns are really keen to humanize politicians with younger voters, make them seem less out of touch. And you can see this with Harris, you know, the Harris campaign using memes and so on. Another thing they've done, another thing the Democrats have done, is actually create this kind of fully fledged creator program where they bring in content creators to make a wide range of content on a wide range of platforms as well. I think this links back to my research in a lot of ways, actually, because this low-cost, short, simple content means that pushing people's emotional buttons rather than rational buttons, I think it matters more than ever in crafting political messaging. You know, short form content, you only have a few seconds to actually really grab people and push their emotional buttons. And we know from the political science research that emotional online content spreads further and faster. So I think that has real consequences for the type of rhetoric we see online and the type of campaign that people are running digitally.
So one thing we've seen in this presidential election is misinformation online and conspiracy theories going viral. Just recently in the presidential debate with Kamala Harris, former President Trump talked about Haitian immigrants eating pets in Ohio. And that's something that spread online really quickly. So how does what you've been looking at and elements like the spiral of silence, how does that interact with online misinformation and the virality of conspiracy theories?
Well, you know, going back to this idea that people evaluate their immediate environment before offering a potentially unpopular or contradictory view, there is some research to show that in a similar way to people not challenging opinions that they disagree with in order to conform with a group. In a similar way, they might not challenge false or dubious information as well. And I think that's quite troubling. You know, for example, we know that bot activity and hate speech have increased massively since Elon Musk took over Twitter and got rid of its content moderation teams. But particularly with the relative ease now with which you can use AI to create bots at scale and the speed by which misinformation can be spread, I think it makes it much more likely that the average person might go online and see hundreds of accounts, for example, spreading nonsense, basically. And taken to its logical conclusion, it makes it less likely that people are going to challenge it. If they think that, you know, 99% of bots online have this opinion, then actually maybe I'm in the wrong as well.
Thank you. I want to go back to the example you used when you were in Wisconsin talking to someone in a bar and how the way we talk about politics online versus in person has changed. We still have conversations in person about politics, but that conversation you mentioned in person would only be among a few dozen people at most who might overhear or be part of your conversation. Whereas on Facebook and other social media platforms, what can start out as a conversation between one or two people or half a dozen in a group can be extended vastly. How does that difference influence the way we talk about politics and the way that then information can spread?
That's a really good question. I think that one of the main ways that it affects the likelihood of people talking about politics and approaching difficult topics is that on social media, content can last forever. So what could start out as quite a good faith attempt to understand somebody else's opinion could later be taken out of context, for example. And again, going back to this idea of having real world social consequences, I think people are quite rightly nervous about you know, approaching topics with somebody from the quote unquote other side. Whereas in a face-to-face setting, for example, there's none of that, is there? I mean, there's this idea that actually maybe you can talk about somebody, talk about something controversial with somebody over a drink, and it's just left there. There are also lots more, you know, quite nuanced social cues you can pick up, which you don't pick up when you're having an online conversation as well. So when we go online and we see actually this person has this in their bio and has lots of, you know, COVID misinformation, I'm very unlikely to agree with them about anything. So I'm just going to go back to my little bubble and I'm not going to talk about this difficult issue.
Thank you. So what's next for your research?
Well, I would like to run the experiment I've been talking about with more participants. So far, I've done it with about 250 people, but for statistical power, I probably need two or three times that at least. So beyond that, I'm really keen to, in some way, make my research have a positive real-world impact. So to that end, I'm always looking out for ways that I could work with, for example, tech companies to improve the way we talk about politics online, or if we can't affect positive change from that direction, maybe working with governments to develop policies which maybe mitigate some of the more negative consequences of talking about politics online, because as we know, there are many, sadly. I think by figuring out what leads people to deliberate in a healthy and a productive way, we can actually use technology to make us, to help us make much better collective decisions. And I'd love to be a part of that.
What responsibility do you think companies, social media companies like Facebook, have towards the content that they publish? I know there's a big debate about whether or not they're just carriers or if they're publishers, and there's been various legal cases and things in the US about that. But these discussions, this misinformation is happening on these platforms. So what responsibility do these platforms have?
Well, I think this is probably not a very helpful and quite cynical response, but I think that they would see their responsibility first and foremost to be to their shareholders. And I think when you look at the profile of the people that are behind tech companies, a lot of them believe quite fundamentally in free speech. You know, Elon Musk talks about himself as being a free speech absolutist, for example. And the sort of consequence of that is that actually it becomes a bit like the Wild West. It becomes a space in which, you know, misinformation is rife and actually some quite harmful things come out of that. Now, I'm not really sure about what the solution is to that. I think that we've seen efforts over the last few weeks to ban social media, ban X in Brazil, for example. We haven't really quite got to grips with what that might mean. It's definitely stoked a lot of existing political tensions. That seems like quite a blunt instrument. I wonder whether there are more nuanced ways to approach it, for example, by legislating social media companies to maybe make their feeds less addictive or to create fewer filter bubbles, fewer echo chambers. Something like that may allow us to work with them, because it feels like the change isn't coming from within at the moment.
Thanks so much. So you were a recipient of a Phelan US Center PhD summer grant in 2022. Can you just talk very briefly about how that grant helped your research?
Yeah, I mean, in short, my research wouldn't have been possible without it, quite honestly. The research grant from the Phelan Center was really instrumental in making my pilot study possible, because it allowed me to pay for targeted Facebook advertising. I did my initial pilot study with that money, and then also used it in further iterations of the study to actually pay participants for their time, to compensate them for their time. And that's really been instrumental in proving that the concept works to people. So if I want to extend it to many more people, I can then take this to other sources of funding and say, look, the Phelan Center actually facilitated this and it works. And it, you know, has some quite interesting implications. So yeah, it's been absolutely fantastic.
Well, thank you so much. Just remains for me to say, Nick Lewis, thank you so much for speaking to The Ballpark.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been lovely.
Nick Lewis is a PhD student at the LSE Department of Government. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks to Nick Lewis for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan US Centre, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. On X and Instagram, we're at @LSE_US, and on Facebook, we're LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Kilson and Henderson Tan. A theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. Look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and unlike lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. You can email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at @LSE_US. And tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It helps other people to find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan US Centre or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.